Welcome back to the show. I'm Travis Chappell, and I believe that if you can connect with the best, you can become the best. So after creating 800 podcast episodes about building your network, I've come to realize that networking is really just making friends, if you're doing it the right way anyway. Join me as I make friends with world-class athletes like Shaquille O'Neal, entertainers like Rob Dyrdek, authors like Dr. Nicole LaPera, former presidents like Vicente Fox, or even the occasional FBI hostage negotiator, billionaire real estate mogul, or polarizing political figure. So if you want to make more friends that help you become a better version of yourself, then subscribe to the show and keep on listening, because this is Travis Makes Friends.
By the time I graduated college, I'd already made $1 million in business. Have you ever seen the movie The Other Guys with Will Ferrell?
Oh, yeah.
Gator?
Yeah.
You know, that was literally like me. Like, they would come and meet me at the colleges, hand me a stack of cash. The second crew would come in, hand me a stack of cash. Night crew goes out, they come in, hand me a stack of cash. Like, three times a day, dude, I was just getting wads of cash. I was either a pimp or a drug dealer, bro. I'm
telling you, you were a pimp.
No. Are you even listening to the story?
I did over $300 million of sales on stage, which is in freaking sane. And then COVID hit, poof, I lose all income. Everything that happens, there's always an opportunity on the other side of it. There's always something. The impact that I'm having now, I never saw it coming. We've only been in business for a year, bro.
Yeah.
Aspire's been a year.
Yeah, that's wild.
And the shit that's coming our way from outside right now, like, hey, we wanna do this with you, we wanna do this with you. And if I started naming names, you'd be like, no fucking way.
What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of Travis Makes Friends. Today, I'm sitting down making friends with Andrew Cordell. What's up, man? Welcome to the show.
What's up, man? Good to be back.
Hey, so I gave you this shot
that
we're going to start the show off with. It's from Magic Mind.
Magic Mind.
Yeah, it's a little matcha shot.
Okay.
It's nootropic, and it's got a little bit of caffeine, not too much.
Okay.
It really helps kick the show off in the proper direction. But I know you're saying you're not a greens guy.
Yeah, dude, I am. Caffeine's not going to bother me. I'm a caffeine guy.
Yeah.
But I don't do anything green.
Minus except like Mountain Dew.
Green Skittles, green Mountain Dew, et cetera. So out of the love of you, Travis, and what you've built with your community, I'm going to... I don't want this to go bad for what Magic Mind.
Hey, you have a Mountain Dew chaser though, so in case you don't like it.
I have not eaten.
The nice thing though for Magic Mind is
bean, a Brussels sprout. I haven't eaten anything green, dude.
Hey, well, the Magic Mind is gonna get a real honest review.
I would rather you give me a line of Coke right now on the show than this. So
it has the same effect, basically.
It does smell good.
See, I told you.
It smells fruity.
It does not taste
it doesn't smell
like most green things.
A green bean.
Yeah, yeah. So, hey, cheers, man.
Okay.
Thanks for coming out.
Thank you for having me.
See how
you
this goes.
You shoot the whole thing at one time?
Yeah, yeah.
Gotcha.
What's the verdict?
Wow. Verdict is... that's actually not that bad. Like, and I would fucking tell you.
I know you would.
I'd fucking tell you.
I would ask for your
honesty.
That's
actually, like, for a guy who literally, like, I have a problem of, like, not eating vegetables. Like, it's a it's like I'm my 8-year-old, you know what I mean? I should probably do more of these.
Yeah, yeah. They're solid, bro.
Like, that's actually, I don't know what's in it.
I completely
trusted you that this is even real. For all I know, we just drank a bunch of shrooms
Oh, we're going to have a great time on this podcast.
That's really good, dude. Give that to my team. I might buy some of those.
Yeah, not bad. Not bad. There you go, Magic Mind.
They're shocked.
Real honest reviews right there. I told them that one. They sent me the first shipment of them, and they did not taste good. And I was like, I like the effect because I could tell it gives me a little bit more mental clarity and things like that when I'm talking, especially when I'm podcasting. But I was like, guys, I'm not gonna shoot this.
Yeah,
it's disgusting.
Yeah.
But yeah, they sent me those ones. They reformulated it, and they sent me those ones, I'm a fan.
Dude, like, I can't even take green vitamins because I know I don't have the nutrients. You know what I mean? Like, I know I don't. I'm not oblivious to it. So sometimes I'm like, okay, Drew, you got to at least take, like, green vitamins to get some green. And I'll literally, like, gag on it.
I don't doubt it, dude. I had some AG1. Uh-huh. Ever had those? Those are the ones that, like, they sponsor every podcast in the world.
Okay.
You know what I mean? And it's Athletic Greens. They send you a big old thing of it. And every review, every person that tries it, you know, I hear them. And then they're like, oh, man, this is actually really good.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, cool, I'll try it out. You know, I tested it. I was like, this tastes like grass clippings in a bottle.
That's what,
like,
I thought.
No. I'm not. Like, I'll drink greens because they're good for me. But stop bullshitting me and telling me that it tastes good because it doesn't.
That's what I'm saying. Like, I'm
pleasantly surprised. Yeah. Like, and I would fucking shoot straight.
Not too bad.
And just tell you.
Not too bad, man.
I'm going to buy some, and at my next event, which is in LA, I'm going to, can you shoot one a day?
Yeah. You get multiple. There's only like 40 milligrams of caffeine, so it's like a half a cup of coffee in terms of caffeine. So everything else is, it's completely natural. There's like nothing bad in it.
Haley, book them. We'll really try them. Stuff. Three in a day.
Yeah. Well, listen, man, welcome to the show. This has been a long time coming. I feel like we first connected back in like, what, 2019? Yeah, pre-pandemic?
No, post-pandemic. Post-pandemic. It was like 2020.
Yeah.
Right, the early beginning piece of it.
It was when nobody was doing events.
No one was doing anything. And I was like, no, we're going to do events. And but the only reason we could, because we had our own space. Without our own space. Like,
yeah. And it was in Utah, which
matter of fact, what's crazy was, because I've been in the event business for so long, when COVID was kind of kicking off, and this had been like, man, maybe like February, March-ish of like 2020, right? I was speaking somewhere in Orlando, I think it was, and they were just starting to come up with all the new like restrictions, right? Like, it was like, okay, masks weren't out yet, but it was like, you have to be 6 feet apart. You have to, there's all these different, like, this is the very, very beginning of it. It wasn't even a lockdown yet, but I was at a hotel speaking, and day one, supposed to be there for 3 days speaking, and half the people actually showed up to it, but then the people in the hotel got so mad, just like, just random people staying in the hotel got so mad at us. They like mobbed the event on day one before we got started and was like, we're going to call the police and we're going to call. And the hotel was actually on our side. They're like, dude, you guys were abiding. The hotel's like, the hotel are abiding by everything.
Yeah.
And, but then they were like, we're going to call the news and my uncle works for so-and-so. We're going to put you on the... And I was like, dude, fuck this. I do not want to be the one guy that's like, you know what I mean? Like at a seminar, leading the way when people are dying. I'm like, I got to. So I literally like canceled the event day one and was like, let's just redo it later or whatever.
And we'll see what happens. Yeah.
Yeah, it was a wild time, man, back in the day of no events for a while.
Yeah, for real. Yeah. So that was, 2020-ish or so, sometime in
there.
We
met, yeah.
And then you started throwing some events at the HQ in Utah. I started coming out there. And started to get to know you and Eddie and kind of the whole crew.
Yeah.
But then watching what you guys have built from where like that company that you were with before, just kind of stopped doing things around COVID time. And then when you started back up, you started from scratch. So it was cool for me to watch an events, like a real events business. Cause that's what you guys are in the events business go from. You know, I think the first events that I went to, there was maybe 20, 30 of us in a room.
Yeah, yeah.
And then now you're selling out 5,000 seats every single month in different cities across the country. And you guys have built that from scratch. And I know that because I witnessed the whole thing. So congrats on all the success on that front. But before we dive into some of that, let's go back in the past a little bit, man, because the first time we met, there was a crazy coincidence that came up.
Okay.
And I sat down in your office and you were about to interview me on the Money Is Show.
Yep.
And you had like your little prep questions or whatever in front of you. And you're like, okay, Chapel, any relationship to Paul?
Paul Chapel. Yeah.
I have not heard that question in a long time. How do you know anything about that world? You know?
Yeah.
So we get to talking and come to find out we grew up basically in the same cult on different sides of the country, going to different kind of colleges, or whatever. But that whole world is all like really intertwined and things. So let's rewind the clock, man. Talk to me like 9, 10-year-old Andrew Cordell. Set the scene. What was life like for you?
Yeah. You know, it's probably part of my side I haven't talked a lot about, which is like the growing up, say, in religious home, right? And so my mom and dad both did not grow up in a Christian home at all. They got into the terminology we would use is got saved and then got into a church when they were like in their maybe mid to late 20s is kind of when they did it. And had no bearing of church at any time, not even like going to Easter Sundays, like nothing, right? And they got into church. And then, so for me though, I was really born in it. Like a lot of, this is funny. I kind of study cults a lot.
Yeah.
Not just religious cults, but cults in general, because there's so many uniqueness inside of understanding them. And one of them is a lot of times you find cults, one piece you can, there's certain common denominators you can always find. Mm-hmm. And one of them is when most of the people there are born into it, it's a telltale sign that something's going on. because the growth is not coming from the message that you have.
Yeah.
The growth is coming from
the regenerating
of the kids. Right. And so anyways, I was born into it, and we were, like you said, we were born in very similar to different sides of the country. I was East Coast, you were West Coast, but same concept of what we were in. And, you know, I think the one thing that saved me, man, from this whole process is, I got really, really lucky from the standpoint of a lot of my friends, that grew up in it the whole time, obviously left, and some of them become bitter. Some of them become upset. Some of them hold grudges, and I'm not even saying right or wrong, or they don't have a reason to or whatever. The thing that saved me was actually my parents. Hmm. I grew up in such a loving home, that it was the cult side of it, if you will, became very, very irrelevant.
Like
to
secondary.
Me. Again, growing up in it and seeing all the pieces to it, the thing was, my parents, for whatever reason, I still to this day don't understand how, and I've done actually a lot of therapy work on this, gave me so much unconditional love. Actually, that if you're in religious, what you refer to as Christ-like love, like if you go book to the book of Ephesians, like literally like unconditional love inside of it. And because of that, I saw a lot of my friends where like their parents would say, quote unquote, love them, but it was very conditional. Like, I love you if you do right. Sure. I love you if you follow these legalistic steps in our church.
If you check all the boxes.
If you don't do these things, I'm gonna be mad at you, and because you didn't do these just weird ass shit things that a man said that we have to go do. And my parents never got into that. My parents were, they wanted me to obey. They wanted me to follow rules. I'm not saying that, but it was always driven by love, never fear. Never, if you don't do this, there's this. So because of it, honestly, God, man, I was really fortunate through a lot of it, because majority of all my friends are, it fucked them up pretty bad.
Sure.
Like just straight up, like it fucked them up pretty bad. And I see a lot of time in religion in general, if you just watch any religion, it's like, this is my opinion about religion, but which this is not a religious podcast, but we'll go here with you.
Yeah.
But to me, it always goes down to, as soon as there's like Jesus or Christ that we follow, as soon as man gets involved, the course of direction goes off just a little bit.
Yeah.
Sometimes
yeah,
it goes
yeah.
way off. Sometimes it goes a little bit off. Yeah. But as soon as man gets involved, you can start the downfall of that quote unquote religion.
Yeah.
Because the men start putting their beliefs, their wants, their needs.
They start worshiping the opinion that they have.
And
hold that as truth instead of looking at
what is. And I'm saying in religion in general, I'm saying across the board.
Yeah.
Not even in our sector. If you just look at religion as a whole, as soon as you see man get involved in religion, men start slowly over time. Even if maybe the first person that started religion wasn't, the second person that comes in, like whatever it is, like you just start seeing men having their opinions, and it starts to separate the follower from Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this almost this go between. And the whole point of religion is that you don't need a go between. That was and is Jesus. But men start inserting themselves as kind of this go-between.
Sure.
And that's what fucks it all up, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And messes
it
up for people.
They start becoming the gatekeepers.
Yeah, gatekeeper into, really, if you do one. This, there's this. If you do this, there's this, you know. Right. And in some religions, it gets really, really bad, where ours, to me, was not at this level. But in some religions, it gets bad where the leader, if you will, is like a decision maker on if you can supposedly even go to heaven or not go to heaven.
Right.
And he's really, like, ours wasn't like to that level. But
because you didn't grow up, did you grow up at Hammond or no?
So I grew up from kindergarten to sixth grade at FBC Hammond.
Okay, you
did. And then moved away to Georgia, where my parents were teachers in an IFB type school. And so then I went from sixth grade to 12th grade. And that was with, for those that listen to even knowing this stuff, that was with like Weiniger, the guy was Bill Weiniger, which ended up also blowing up later in affairs and so forth. But was like a leader, kind of what maybe we would call like a regional leader, in it.
Yeah.
And then I went back to FEC for college.
For college.
Right.
And that's where you met Eddie, no?
I met Eddie later. We crossed paths later.
Okay.
Because he was there for a little bit, but it was after I was already gone. And so then I spent another, whatever it was, 5 years there in college. Left, And then that was kind of it for that side of it. I stayed in the IFB world for probably another, 3 or 4 years. And then
like
just
working in ministry or?
No, I never did ministry. I started my first business in college and finished college. But by the time I graduated college, I'd already made $1 million in business. And
gotcha.
You know, in that world, which was wild, in that world, that was like, you know, you were freaking next level business person. You know, to be 21 years old and made $1 million was like unheard of. And so because of that, they actually like supported me going into business.
Oh, did they?
Yeah. It was like, oh yeah, you should do that.
Interesting. Yeah. I found it to be the opposite for me was when, like I started making money. The kind of authority there was like, hey, time to give that up and go into ministry.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
It's time to be done with the money thing. And
right.
Like, that was nice for a little bit, but like now it's time to like give everything to God or whatever.
Right. Right.
But, I think there's like this weird now, like as you know, a grown man looking back on it, I can see a little bit more context there. And it was always interesting to me because like it was always preached to me my whole life that like, you know, the love of money is the root of all evil you know, it's bad to go do these things. But then I would see the staff when like a rich person would come on campus and they would wine and dine them and they would be the most important person. And the crazy thing was like that person wouldn't even be fully bought into all the beliefs that we have. Like that person could be a community church Christian, which we would look at as like not a real Christian at that time.
Fake. Yeah.
Yeah. And
we had to
and
pray for a soul.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So like they would allow that person to come on campus and then just be treated like this God.
Red
and
carpet.
Was like, wait a second. Like you told me I shouldn't go pursue making money and that I'm not allowed to be a community church, you know, Laodicean lukewarm Christian.
Yep.
But that guy already has money and is that type of person. And you're going to like make a statue with his name on it because he paid for the building that you're building here. It was like, I saw that all the time, man.
Same thing with politicians.
Oh yeah.
Politicians would come in and it was just like roll the freaking red carpet out.
Yeah.
With them or whatever. But yeah, for me, it was a little bit different because we were again, East Coast, West Coast. And for me, I hit it and hit it pretty big, you know. I mean, again, here I was 21 years old and had a multi-state business. And
what was the business?
My very first business I started in college was window cleaning.
Okay,
commercial window cleaning, and then I got into pressure washing from there. But then I ended up getting contracts with like McDonald's, Home Depot, Starbucks, Arby's, Buffalo Wild Wings, and so I was at that point covering like three different states with these big contracts, you know, and had a bunch of college guys working for me and.
Nice.
And so they kind of all knew it, and I was funding a lot of stuff for people, you know. Yeah. I was like, oh yeah, because for me, money is weird. You know, my whole brand is teaching about money and talking about money, but a weird point for me is like money is almost like irrelevant to me. Like I don't have a lot of value on money
by itself.
Sure. Like I can go to zero and don't give a shit. Like I can have money. I mean, I like have money. I want money. I enjoy having it. But on the same hand, I can lose it all and I have lost it all. And it's like, oh, well, like it's
energy.
It's like,
flows in, flows out.
It's okay. Like, it doesn't, you know, it's part of it, but, inside of that world there, you know, it was just a big deal. And so I kind of became a little, a big fish in a small pond when it came to business.
Right.
And they started like pushing. I remember I had this final meeting of like, I was getting offers and this was also wild. This was so freaking crazy. I really didn't even, you know, the college I went to, you had to like work in certain ministries, right? And do certain things.
Yep.
I really wasn't even doing that.
Oh, really?
Because my biz was so big and a lot of it was on weekends and stuff. And so I was doing the very minimum requirement that they made you do. However, I was getting offers from like every big name pastor in our circle, right? They were all hitting me up with job offers.
Yeah.
And it was wild because looking back on it, like you say, looking back is like, here's all my like kind of buddies or friends or not even friends, but just people in college with me. They're like pouring their heart into this ministry.
Doing all the things they're supposed to be doing.
Right. So that they can get out of there and go get a full-time job and as an assistant pastor or whatever it was. And they're getting zero offers. Here I am doing the bare minimum. Sometimes I'm doing that and getting just multiple job offers from every big pastor out there, which is, again, it goes back to, you start looking at it like,
yeah,
why?
I wonder why.
I was getting out of that job over. And then I went to that kind of the pastor there was trying to get like counsel from him, like, hey, which one of these job offers do you think I should take? You know, like these are all like really big cream of the crop from where we were, you know?
Yeah.
And he's like, dude, you should take none of those. And you should go into business. Like, you have a freaking gift for it and you should go into business. And probably the best advice I got, because, you know, honestly, if he'd have said you should go to this one, I probably would have did it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But he didn't. He actually said, look, you have a unique gift, a new unique skill set, and I think you should stay in business. And now, again, was there some self reasoning there for him? Yes, because I think he wanted me to stay there, make all the money and give it to the church for him.
Don't forget about your tithe check.
Yeah. And offerings and all the other ones.
Missions.
But long story short, he didn't. He said go into business, so I went to business. And since then, I've been in business. I started my first business, like true business, when I was 20 years old. I was 19 years old. And then now I'm 41 and I've been in business. Yeah, I've never had a job since then, the whole time.
What years were you there at Hammond?
For college or for school?
For college.
College 2000 to 2005.
So this was Scott then?
Yeah. So when I first started, it would have been Hiles.
Yeah.
First there for like a year.
Yeah.
And he ended up passing away my freshman year.
Okay.
And then Scott came in, you know, kind of my sophomore year, basically, or whatever. Okay. And so then sophomore through was Scott.
Okay. So yeah. Were you in the auditorium for the polishing the shaft sermon?
The famous one that's on YouTube right now? Because he preached that sermon like 50 times.
The one that got famous.
Yeah.
Of course it hurts. Of course it's fire. Of course it's pain. Gosh, just shut up. I can handle it. I know what I'm doing. Oh, God, that hurts. Oh, God, I'm so tired. Oh, God, I didn't want to lose her. Oh, God, I didn't want to have that pain. Oh, God, no.
But no, the one that was there, that's like the YouTube famous one, I was not there. I was already gone because that was like 2000, I don't know, like 8 or 9 or something. I've seen it. No, I was not there for that one. But I have seen, I've been in the service when he is.
For that exact sermon.
And here's what's crazy, man, which a lot of people don't know this, but normally, this is so wild. When he originally first started preaching that sermon, right? I was in high school when it actually first came out. That sermon first came out, right?
Okay.
So this would have been like 1999.
Yeah.
Around the time frame that sermon first came out. He preached that sermon at my high school on like when he wasn't the pastor yet.
Sure.
And the way that he used it in all the years that he did it until that one, you know how he used to do it?
No.
The way that he used to do it made a lot of sense. But that one is like, you're watching it and you're like, I don't even understand what's happening right now. The way that he used to do it was he would actually get a stick, like an old stick from a tree and a knife. And then he would kind of like carve the knife.
Okay.
And he'd make an arrow
out
of the knife. And he'd put a point on the tip of it and there'd be like a bump in the stick or whatever. And then he would like sit there and like trim that off. And he would use the knife, a big Bowie knife.
Yeah.
And he would trim like and make an arrow. Okay. Sure. That was the one. And which makes a lot more sense because he was trying to say, like, you know, God hasn't to test you to see if you'll, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And that one makes more sense and is not this sexual innuendo. But then the one on YouTube, which I wasn't there for, I never saw that one. It looks like a Saturday Night Live skit.
It's my favorite like, there's sermon no way clip it's real. I've ever seen in my life.
There's no way this is real. Like, if you ever watch it, I watched the men on the platform, their faces.
Yeah.
None of them break. None of them like.
Yeah, no.
They're just like. Mm-hmm,
That could easily be Will Ferrell. Like,
yeah.
You know, like literally doing a sketch. It's so mind-blowingly like, this is not real.
Facial
right?
expressions, yeah. hand gestures, yeah. what he was using, noise, like all of it. There's no way. I don't know. Like, dude, that was, it's wild.
Anytime I need a good laugh, bro.
Because you know the background of it, it's like, how did you go from like carving a stick to an arrow?
Well, what's funny is I never saw that until after everything came out.
Again, let's give you a little bit of background about Jack Scop. He was the lead pastor of the Hammond Baptist Church until his firing last July. Prosecutors say that he took advantage of a troubled 16-year-old girl who was a parishioner at the fundamentalist megachurch in Northwest Indiana and had come to him for counseling
because I was on tour for West Coast during the summer where everything came out, and then I saw that clip afterward and it was one of those just like, yeah, I think there were some signs, guys.
Yeah, no, there were definitely. I was gone by
there might have been a thing or two that would have tipped
us
off.
I had been gone for maybe like 5 years when all of it actually finally like broke or whatever it was, and I remember getting the news of it thinking there's no freaking way, but then as you go back, it was crazy. The assistant that turned him in,
okay,
who actually found the iPad, let's say, mm-hmm. and actually turned him in, works for me.
Oh, really?
To this day. Yeah. Wow. He's a like an IT tech wizard.
No way.
Like, that's what he does. And to this day, he works for me. And so I actually have like all kinds of like pretty in-depth information. And then matter of fact, wild. His, because I ended up moving back up there to that area. It already happened. He was already sentenced. He was already in jail. So this is several years later, maybe 3 years or 2 years, something later. I ended up moving back up there to do a bunch of real estate deals with a buddy and was there for like 2 years. Well, while I was there, there was that massive transition going on in the church, right?
Yep.
And there was a lot of really good workers, like straight up like worker bees,
yeah.
There. And two of them were on his staff three of his personal staff I hired.
Oh, really?
And one of them to this day still works for me.
Yeah.
And the one that works for me lives in Florida now. But he was the one who actually turned him in, and he still works for me to this day in like IT. So I don't do fucking anything with that with iPads or on that dude. Yeah. Like fuck, I don't post anything. Yeah. It's all like, you know, Apple's always like, do you want to sync this? I'm like, fuck no, I don't want to sync any shit.
It's all analog with him. Yeah, like, I write him letters.
Yeah. So yeah, but all three really good people, and I have a lot of behind the scenes information because they stay through the whole time.
Yeah.
During the transition. Travel. Yeah. Yeah.
It was so wild, man. That was such a crazy.
It was a crazy time in life, bro, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, IFB has not gotten much better since then. Really.
No, I would say it's probably got worse.
Yeah,
from a standpoint of his scouting, it's what I would call it's very inbred.
Mm-hmm.
Is
oh,
the
yeah,
issue
totally
is the biggest issue, and
the people are just getting weirder and weirder and less in touch with reality as time goes on.
At that moment when all that went down, a positive that could have taken place from there. I mean, a lot of that was obviously negative, but a positive that could have taken place was it could have been a giant shift in that whole, say, religion, if
sure.
you will.
Yeah,
and they could have said, "Hey, from that, let's take this as all past and look for the new direction of who we, our identity, our brand should be."
Yeah.
And they didn't. They doubled down on their brand, which is already a dying fucking brand. It's like your Blockbuster, and you doubled down on that shit.
Yeah.
Even though Netflix just came out with like, not only like, it was like, this is a great analogy. It's like, they were Blockbuster. Netflix already came out and was crushing you. And then Netflix then starts, well, that's when they had, Netflix had like the mail-in DVDs though.
Yeah.
Imagine Netflix, you still stay at Blockbuster stores. Then Netflix goes online TV, which is what we all watch now.
Yep.
Okay, that's where it was, how far of a gap it was. And then your brand at Blockbuster, and then you being the leader of Blockbuster, like, you know what? Fuck it. Let's just double down in what we currently have of more stores.
Yeah. Or we need to double our late fees.
Yeah, it's like we need to charge more if they don't rewind the VHSs for us. Like, that was the concept of, like, from a business perspective of looking at it, it was like, dude, that was like a moment you could have shifted, and they didn't. They doubled down on it, and to me, it's gotten worse. I mean, I don't have anything to do with it anymore. I'm kind of probably a unique one where, like, I don't hate them. I don't know if I'd even say I'm against them. I just don't care. It's like I am agnostic to any of that stuff.
Well,
it's like
there's good people and bad people everywhere.
Yeah.
In business and churches. Like you obviously hope to see fewer of them in churches, but that's just not the case. It's just, you know, there's always going to be a percentage of people that suck and there's going to be a percentage of people that are good people.
And it's also just my viewpoint of life in general. I tend to be a very optimistic, positive, find the positive in the scenario type of person. And so, you know,
it's much more beneficial to do that.
Yeah. Looking at all of it, it's like, there was a lot of fucked up shit there, but there's a lot of positive I can find in my own life from it. But again, I have friends that are all negative, and borderline is probably hurt them.
Yeah,
because they almost can't get past it.
Definitely.
What I mean,
that bitterness root just takes hold.
Yeah, and it's stuck in them, and they can't get over it. And everything that happens in their life, they almost blame it on that still.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And it's like, dude, like, I get it. It was fucked up, but
either
you're going to stay there, live there, or you're going to move on. You know, but it's the same thing. Like, you look at business with, like, COVID, right? COVID was a scenario where it absolutely fucked a lot of people in business. Like, just wiped out businesses in a whole, myself included. Remember, before COVID, I wasn't even what I would call in business for myself. I was a independent contractor. I was speaking for a company. I was with them now at that point for like 6 years, made millions of dollars. I was making ballpark, like per weekend, I was making $35,000 to $50,000 a weekend paycheck.
Pure commissions.
Just pure commission paycheck, 35 to 50
Which is the best kind because there's no expenses that come.
No overhead, right? Like they'd fly me out to somewhere to speak. Right. I would. They'd pay for my ticket. They pay for my hotel room. They give me food money per diem. I had a full team that traveled with me, but they paid for all their expenses and all their staff, all their pay. I didn't have to pay for any of them. So I had my own team, and then we would go to different, you know, cities or countries, and I would travel and speak. And again, so you have like no overhead, including travel, airfare, hotel, and you're making $35,000-$50,000 a weekend, pure profit, dude.
Yeah.
And then COVID hit, and I literally was on stage, and the moment that I was on stage when it hit, I was, that was my 96th weekend in a row, where I had never, I went through this stretch. I spoke for like 7 years, and most of the time, most speakers take a weekend off a month. Every month they take one weekend off. Most speakers have to because you'll get burnt out.
No kidding.
And I did that for several years. And then on this one stretch, man, I would just hit it wide open. And I was on 96 weekends in a row. My guys were rotating off weekends. But I was on, that was my 96th weekend in a row. And when COVID hit, and it could have absolutely, and it did. Most guys that are in my space got murdered. Mm. Murdered because they didn't. Because it goes back to the, there's this bad negative thing that takes place. Yeah. Here we are 4 or 5 years later, and there's guys that I work with that made millions of dollars. They don't have anything. They're done. They can't. They can't. All they do is live back
and like, still blaming COVID.
Like, man, man, could you imagine if we're like, well, no, you can't imagine because it's fucking gone. It's not going to come back.
Right.
You got to move forward with it. And for me, inside of COVID is where I birthed my company, Aspire.
Yeah.
Because again, I'm always looking for the positive or the silver lining inside of it. Inside of what we, anything I got going on, I do it.
It's one of the most powerful questions I feel like that I ask myself and that I encourage people to ask themselves is it happened, now what?
Yeah. Okay.
You know, like, okay, that
sucks.
Exactly. You can acknowledge it sucks. You know what I mean? Like you don't have to pretend it doesn't suck.
Right.
Like, cause that like, that's to me bordering into this toxic positivity where you're just like, deluding yourself into believing that all everything's awesome all the time. It's like, well, everything's not awesome all the time. Sometimes
shit happens
and it sucks, and it sucks bad.
Yeah, yeah.
But it happened. Mm-hmm. So what are you going to do now? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, where do we go from here? Because the option that doesn't make any sense is to continue dwelling on the thing that already happened because it's done. It's happened. Like, we cannot change it. It happened. So what are we going to do? How are we going to fix it? What's the next step? You know what I mean?
It's just a unique life.
We can adopt that mindset.
A lot of people don't have, but I think it goes back to, I would say a point that even positive people miss is the first point you said, which is you have to take time to acknowledge how shitty it was.
Yes.
Like you can't just like run through it like, oh, well, fuck it. Next thing. It's not me nor you are trying to sit here and say, just go to the next thing. Again, I'm making, let's say on average, $40,000 every Friday. No outgo. Just 40 grand, yeah. 40 grand, 40 grand,
yep.
Working 3 days on, 4 days off, right? And in that one thing, one decision that was made, poof, I lose all revenue, I lose all income. Mm-hmm. No, there's no more. I never got another speaking check moving forward. Still to this day, I haven't got a check like that, meaning not that size, but that style where it's just like as an independent contractor.
Right.
Because it doesn't exist anymore, right? And in it, you know, I did take time and like, think through like, dude, how fucking bad does this suck? Like, holy shit. Yeah. I would have been on weekend, like right now, I don't know, shit. I'd be on like weekend 312,
yeah,
a 40 grand a weekend.
Just clocking cash.
Clocking it away. And, but the positive is number one, like you said, you have to, number one, take time to acknowledge that it's bad. It sucks. Here's what sucks about it. It's okay to like grieve over it. It's okay to acknowledge it. It's okay to cry over it. It's okay to be upset about it. It's okay to vent about it. But at some point you have to turn that page. And I think those are two steps there that a lot of people miss. Either A, they try to turn the page too fast and live in a fake world of like, everything is just great. That's not true. Or they refuse to turn the page and they get stuck on this sucks, this sucks, this sucks. But it's those two steps, right? Like acknowledge it, feel how bad it sucks. And then turn that page and say, okay, now what? No, because on everything that happens, there's always an opportunity on the other side of it. There's always something. It's just those that are looking for that next thing that takes place. And for me, it was Aspire. If that would not have happened, would my life be good? Yes. Would my life be, would I make good money? Sure. Yeah. I mean, 40 grand a week is pure profit, is really good for a lot of people.
For pretty much anybody.
For pretty much anybody. 40 grand a week, you're making, and what is it, 120 grand a month?
Yeah.
Traveling. and speaking, like, dude, like, yeah, it's 40, 80, 120, 160, 160 grand a month and traveling and speaking, like, dude, that's a good gig. But I wouldn't be where I'm at right now. I make way more than $160,000 a month right now. But it's not even about the money side. It's about the impact that I'm having now and the influence I'm having is worth way more than the 40 grand a weekend.
Yeah.
And again, along with that comes more than 40 grand a weekend, but without the positive attitude, that none of that stuff ever happens, you know?
So let's take a little bit back into the story here. So you have this kind of window washing commercial business, and you're in pressure washing and things like that. How long do you do that for? What'd you get out of that? Because I want to try to bridge the gap here between that, because you were doing that, and then at some point you decided to get involved in investing in real estate, and then you started speaking and all that kind of stuff. So
yeah, so for me, window cleaning was just an accident. What I mean by that is, like, I started in college, and the only reason I started window cleaning was because I had no money. Mm-hmm. Right, it wasn't like it was some brilliant freaking business idea.
Here's my business plan.
I had $0, as a college student, and so I started window cleaning, literally almost by accident. And then once I got into it, I just stayed with it and built a $1 million company. Well, by the time I got out of, when I was in college, I knew I did not want to do this. Like, this was not going to be my gig. It's cool, I'm making a shit ton of money, and I was like, it always reminds me of do you ever see the movie The Other Guys with Will Ferrell?
Oh yeah,
dude,
it's classic.
Gator.
Yeah.
That was literally like me, like, because I had guys that would work around the clock. I was making money 24 hours a day. This is how wild
you
it
were
was.
A pimp.
I was a straight up gator, because what would happen was the guys worked 24 hours a day. Well, most of the money that we would come in was cash, just how that business operates. So just if you think about this, every day at the end of routes, right? So I was going to college in the morning shift, there'd be guys working for me. They would come and meet me at the colleges, hand me a stack of cash. Afternoon shift would go. I'd be in the college hanging out in the dorms or, out of the different areas they have. The second crew would come in, hand me a stack of cash. Night crew goes out. They come in, hand me a stack of cash. Like, just three times a day, dude, I was just getting wads of cash. I was either a pimp or a drug dealer, bro. But in college, I knew, like, I don't want to do this forever. I started getting into real estate or learning about real estate. I spent probably 2 years straight of just learning, reading, going to events, seminars, and gig around anybody I could that was in real estate.
Okay.
And that's how I ended up. So when I left college, I split that company three different ways and sold it to three different people. And the only reason I did that was because I can make more money that way. If I sold it to one person, I was going to make less money off of it. And so I split that money, and then I got into real estate and started real estate in 2005. Bought my first fix and flip house in 2005. And within 90 days, I bought it, fixed it up, sold it, and I made like $32,000 on my very first deal, and made it within 90 days. My mom and dad were still school teachers, and they were on summer break. And I remember I bought that house, fixed it up, renovated it, put it back in the market, closed it inside of their summer break. Hmm. Right. And if you know that world, like, that's more than most Christian school teachers make in a year. Yep. $32,000. Right. And I made it in the summer break they were off.
My job offer, I had a job offer for an assistant pastor role, my senior year of college, and it was for $16,000.
Yeah, so that sounds right.
Yeah, that was double what they were going to pay.
And here's another piece of it.
I never took it, by the way.
Here's another piece I love, which we should probably do another podcast just on Colts. Your wife probably also would get an offer, but it would only be at $12,000.
Oh,
same job. So you know what I mean?
Spot on, bro. Spot on. She was going to be the secretary, and it was $8,000. So I can remember it like it was yesterday, because it was the most like suffocating, claustrophobic feeling I ever felt. I was like in a giant auditorium. There was no reason to feel claustrophobic. It was just that he said that to me. He was like, $16,000 for you. And he was like, but don't worry, your wife will be our secretary and we'll pay her $8,000. So that'll be $24,000 total, okay, which is more than enough to live in our town. I was like, get me out of this interview.
That's it, bro. My mom and dad were both school teachers. They had the exact same degree from exact same college. Okay. One didn't have a master's or something like that.
Yep.
Same degree, same teaching. But my dad made like $4,000 more than my mom.
Really?
Yeah, like their whole career. And it's like there was, and my mom was a better teacher. She like built out a curriculum.
They're just so blatant about it. You know what I mean?
Right in your face. Like, is there a difference? Well, you're a female.
Yeah, right. Like, we have to call you Mrs. and you Mr. Yeah. So, or brothers.
Yeah, So it's gonna, you're gonna make more. So it's wild. So then I launched into real estate, and then got to real estate. Was in real estate and made a lot of money in real estate. Doing a bunch of deals, did hundreds and hundreds of deals.
All flips.
But did all fix and flips.
You said 2005, though. Yeah. So this was like
subprime.
But a year and a half of prime, 2 years maybe, until everything kind of went to shit, right?
So mine crashed like 2008.
Okay.
The city that I was in, Atlanta at the time. Okay. So mine kind of went all to hell in a handbasket. I think it was 2008. So I ran it from like 2005 to 2008. I probably blitzed through, I don't have the exact number, but I probably blitzed through like 200 houses that time frame.
Okay.
Right? Like I hit it and was like, poof, wide open.
Yeah.
But only fix and flips in 2008, kind of market finally hits Atlanta and then poof, it crashes. I get stuck. I lose everything. And then that's how I ended up, how I went back to Chicago for a while.
Okay.
Was my best friend from school, still my best friend today, Mike Wittig, who's a great guy. You don't have a good fucking podcast, dude. Bring Mike Wittig on, bro. You will die laughing.
Let's do it.
Especially about the religion stuff and business.
Yeah.
And so he was doing real estate, but he was doing rentals. And I was doing flips. He was doing rentals. Okay. And his dad probably at that time owned like 300 rental properties at the time.
Okay.
Anyways, I hit him up and like, dude, I'm unemployed. Like my wife left me. I've lost my house, my cars. I have zero. Yeah. I am living in my parents' basement this time in 2008. And I get to get a job for him as like an intern, basically for $10 an hour. I take an intern job. And the only reason I did it was because I knew that I was missing a piece of investing.
Sure.
I knew I could go back and flip eventually, but there was a reason. Like they were not going under, and here I was losing everything. And so I take this job and as an intern and for a year and focused on learning cash flow for a year. And I was driving his, he had an old like, gosh, I don't know at the time. It had been 2008, 2009 time frame. He had probably like a 1995 Volkswagen Jetta diesel that he gave me to drive. It was wrecked in the back of it. I was like sleeping.
Those diesels
like,
will go along forever.
They would go
though,
forever. You know what I mean? So it's like, you know, and then I was like couch surfing during this time. And it was like, again, if you think about it, it was like $16,000 a year.
Yeah, right.
Money or whatever. But anyways, I did it for a year and learned a shit ton about this kind of the other side of the business and left after a year and then got back into flipping and rental properties. And then from like 2000, again, don't want me to do the exact dates, but like from 2010-ish, 11, all the way to 2000, basically 16, I was like full-time fix and flip and then rentals, tax liens and all kinds of stuff. Probably did another like close to probably 800 properties that time frame. I was blistering through houses, different style of houses. I could go a lot faster. And then I got recruited by this company, which is pretty wild. And this was a mistake I made in business. This is one of the mistakes I look back at and think, God, I wish I would have kept doing that. And what it was this was like in 2010, I started getting back into fix and flips a lot, 2010, 11. And, you know, I was doing like maybe, I might've had like any given time, 20 to 50 houses going on, right? Mm-hmm. Somewhere in the kind of pipeline of like, I'm buying it or I'm looking at it, I'm buying it, I'm rehabbing it, I'm putting it on the market, I'm closing it, right? So it was like 20 to 50, depending on where we were in the year. And I hired a guy and just said, dude, I just want you to follow me around and shoot YouTube videos for me. And I don't have anything for sale. I have nothing for sale. I just want to like I'm actually doing real estate.
Right, right.
And I you know, when I grew up, there was a lot of people teaching real estate, but they actually didn't fucking do real estate.
Yeah, right.
Or they did it 15 years ago. And it's like, dude, what you're doing doesn't work anymore.
Yep.
And so I'm like, dude, I'm actually doing it. Like, just come record it. I'm just going to teach people how to go do what I'm doing for free. And so I started a YouTube channel and we were just pumping out videos because I would just go from house to house to house like day after day and be like, okay, let's talk about kitchens. And I had like playlist of all these kitchens and playlists of bathrooms and playlists of exterior, interior, like all this stuff, right? Nothing to sell. Just pumped all these videos out. And because of that, the largest education company in the world at the time, that's how they found me.
Gotcha.
Was, dude, I wasn't looking for to change. I was just doing this. And then that's how they found me was my YouTube channel. Brought me out and asked me if I wanted to start speaking, like teaching real estate. And I was like, oh, yeah. I mean, that's how I learned originally from it. And so that's how I got into the teaching side of it. I kept flipping houses. That was like 2000, again, close dates here, but like 14-ish, 15 is when they actually recruited me.
Okay.
I kept doing a shit ton of flips to like 2016 and then was speaking all the time and started to slow down the flips and then took like a year off of flips and then cranked it up again. I was back in Atlanta now. Cranked it up again, started doing another from like 2016 to 2018-ish, probably did another 150 houses or so. And then finally it's like, okay, my speaking is like so hot right now. Mm-hmm. I was the number one speaker in this company. It was the largest real estate education company in the world. And I was the number one speaker at this company. And it was like, okay, I got to go all in on this.
Yeah.
Because there's something here that I could get deeper with. And so that's how I got into that. So then I kind of stopped doing the real estate, went full time dedicated into speaking and like perfecting that craft. And that year, those next 3 years or whatever it was, like 2.5 really had been like 2017 ish, 18, 19. When I went on the like 96 weekends in a row, I did over $300 million of sales on stage, which is in freaking sane to do that much revenue on stage speaking. But it was my hyper focus was like become the best at that. And then COVID hit and the story goes from there with Aspire. But
got it.
Yeah, it's pretty wild, the transition there.
Curious on what your thoughts are in how, like the way that you grew up.
Yeah.
Being inundated with speaker, and especially in somewhere like FBC where,
right.
I mean, this is, for those listening that don't know, this is a church of what, 20, 30,000 at the time.
Yeah.
Like there's a massive church.
Yeah.
And when they're bringing in speakers, they're bringing in like orators, like just real bona fide, legitimate speakers who can move entire audiences,
move
create
crowd.
Emotional connect, yep. like masters at their craft.
Masters at it.
How much do you think that, I guess, affected your ability to pick up on speaking when you started getting into it full time?
A decent amount for sure, because I think the big piece that if you understand public speaking as a whole, and this is where a lot of people go wrong at public speaking, you could have a great truth, right? That your topic or your truth is really, really strong. Mm-hmm. But if you do not know how to move the crowd, if you do not know how to entertain the crowd, if you do not know how to connect with the crowd to have them catch your truth or your vision, your speaking career will be one of very, very small.
Be over before it starts.
And you'll be doing these random ass keynote presentations, 45, and you'll probably, like most people, they'll start paying for speaking slots. Mm-hmm. And it's really just a sponsorship that you have, but you're on stage, so it looks like you're speaking and you're trying to get going your career. I'm not even saying it's bad, but that's really most of what's happening. Mm-hmm. What that group of people knew how to do was they knew how to take a truth, and this is actually funny, you'll actually know what I'm talking about here. We're kind of bounce back and forth between our religion and then like business, but you'll know this piece of
there's
it.
A lot of overlap.
There's a lot of overlap here. the unique thing about this is they would not take like 55 scripture verses and use 55 different verses to explain the truth that they were teaching.
Yeah, yeah.
They use basically one verse, mm-hmm. right? And they would take that one verse and that would be their truth,
45
right?
minutes.
And so because of that, you'd have to understand what they were really doing was taking an idea, a philosophy of a certain verse. They were taking their opinion, if you will, of this verse. They mm-hmm. wouldn't necessarily, and I'm speaking in a broad stroke here, but
sure.
for the most part, they wouldn't then say, here's this truth, and then let's go to this verse in this scripture and go to this, and let's chronologically lay this out in the order of how Christ was doing this on earth when he was here, whatever it was, right? They didn't do that.
They weren't teaching a theology lesson.
No. Yeah. They were teaching, like, here's this one word, edify, that I found in the Bible. Like, the word, just edify. And they would do a 45-minute sermon off of one word called edify, mm-hmm. right? However, that was the dumb part, okay? But my point to you is they would take a concept, a truth, or a philosophy called the word edify, and then they would build a 45-minute hour presentation or sermon around that. And what they were good at was getting 8,000, 9,000 people mm-hmm. emotionally connected with the truth or philosophy or opinion they had, and then creating a scenario where that 8,000 people had a CTA, mm-hmm. what we do in the business, in scripture or in religion, they would call it an altar call. Mm-hmm. That's the call to action, yep. right? So what growing up, what you would see is I would see someone, if you look at it, it was like taking a truth, if you will, not actually explaining it, but taking a truth, moving the audience, moving emotionally the crowd, and then having a call to action.
Yep.
Well, in public speaking, you got to look at it from two sides. This is where most people go wrong at. There is the science of public speaking, and there is the art of public speaking. Mm-hmm. There's a science and there's an art to it. Most public speakers they understand the science side of it. The science is the easiest part. The science is just understanding, here's my topic, here's my outline, mm-hmm. here's what I have to cover, right? Bop, 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 bop. the art of public speaking is understanding how to create connection, to create stories, stories that tie back to a main point. And it's all one giant movie script almost, yeah. That you're taking the customer on a journey that yeah. they can go along with you. If they choose, they can go along with you. But because you're able to entertain while deliver truth by using emotions inside of speaking in a good way, then when there is a call to action, there's a reason for them to do it. There's yeah. a reason for them to move. But it takes 45 minutes or so to get to that point inside of it. So a lot of what I saw subconsciously, if you will, growing up, yeah. was the art of public speaking. Not the science, yep. but the art of public speaking. And it was understanding the journey that they would go on. And then there's the emotional side of it. There's pain inside of it. There's a story, stories that they're going to use to tie their main truth back into it. And there's going to be a call to action at the end of it. That's going to, mm-hmm. and the call to action is going to match the emotional side they created over here. If you watch great speakers, Tony Robbins, that can move an audience, right? Mm-hmm. I'm not saying they're great orators and they can stand behind a podium, whether it be for scripture, for religion, or a keynote presentation, and they can wax eloquently for 30 minutes. You're like, oh, that was really cool. I'm talking about the people that can move people.
Yes.
That's what they're doing.
Yeah.
It is what they're doing. They are taking their philosophy, their truth, or whatever it may be, and they're connecting with energy and emotion through mm-hmm. storytelling that can then lead to a call to action based off of the emotion and the pain that was created through that speaker.
Yeah, and they'll so, like, I can always tell when somebody's going to be not as great at doing those things just by how many slides they use in a presentation.
Yeah.
Or like, you know, like great speakers, they need bones. That's yep. all. Just a rough outline.
Yep.
Just like an index card with like 3 points on it so that they yep. don't lose their place in their mind. And then they just go and they tell stories and they connect with the audience and they focus way more like... you don't hear the same speech twice, even when you do hear the same speech twice.
Correct.
If that makes sense. Yep, it's like, 100%. It was the same talk, but it was different because yep. this audience was in Atlanta versus this audience was in New York versus this one was in Utah. And the way that this speaker is connecting with each of those audiences is wildly and vastly different because they all come from different backgrounds, different cultures, different contexts. And that speaker knows how to like connect with those people mm-hmm. and then draw out and elicit an mm-hmm. emotion from those people mm-hmm. in order to make that emotion make a decision.
Correct.
Like when it comes down to decision making time, and they understand that bottom line, we're all creatures of emotion. Even the people who raise their hand and be like, I'm a logical decision maker. It's like, at the end of the day, we're not. We're still emotional decision makers. And you might be less emotional than somebody else, but you're still making decisions based on emotion. And the best speakers know how to draw out that emotion, get you to feel that emotion, and then get you to take the next step because of it.
Yeah, dude, what you said is very, very true. Like, I've never taught a class on public speaking. I don't really have a desire to. I get offered all the time, mm-hmm. like six figures, like, hey, will you sit down with me and like craft my presentation and teach me how to, and I'll give you $100,000. I've never done it before. But in doing it, there's certain pieces that I know that works inside of it. And I don't mean, to be clear with the audience, I don't mean this weird shit of NLP. Mm-hmm. So there's this, for years, there was this concept of like, your body motion. I'm not even saying it wasn't true. I'm just saying I don't want to hypnotize you. I don't want to trick you.
I don't
want to
be weirdly manipulative.
Yeah, I don't want to be weirdly manipulative. I want to aspire you that if my message is connecting with you, I want to aspire you enough to do something about it. Mm-hmm. I don't want to put you in some trance and manipulate you because I'm moving my right arm 45 times at a 33 degree angle that shows you that I'm
because
willing
I got you to say
help
the
you.
Word yes 42
yeah.
times.
Yeah. That shit drives me crazy. Yeah. I have no presentations where I'm like, now say yes, or double clap, pop, pop, because they're creating this like rhythm. And when they do that, they're trying to create a rhythm into what
yeah.
they're doing.
Yeah.
I hate all that shit. Not saying it doesn't work, to be clear. I'm just saying I hate all of it. Yeah. But what you said, there's two pieces you said that are very true. Number one, when you find a great speaker who understands truly speaking, what you said is 100% true. You could make I make the same, in theory, presentation month after month after month after month. Same hour and a half presentation. However, people that have heard it, that follow me, will fly into all these different cities on a monthly basis. There'll be 5,000, 4,000, 3,000 people there. And then there'll be another 100, 200, 300 that have heard the same presentation. And they bought the thing that I was wanting to do. They bought it, and now they follow me. And when I get done, they're like, dude, I've never heard you say that before. And I'm like, bro, this is your 9th presentation that you've been to.
I said this a week ago.
But the difference is, because it's a different crowd,
yeah,
because it's maybe more Republican crowd, maybe more a Democrat crowd, because it's a different state, different demographics, there's so many things that go into it, which will change the art of how you're presenting. The facts will be the facts. The science will be the science. But the art will change inside of it. So it sounds like a different presentation. And it may be because I lean heavier on a certain jokes here or there, or take away certain jokes I'm not going to say. Certain cities I'll cuss more inside of. Certain cities I'll pull back from. That's one piece. You'll always find a great one. The other piece that you said is very, very true. People mess up on slides all the time.
Oh, yeah.
And they think that you'll see this. As soon as you see this on a presentation, you might as well just leave.
Yeah.
Whenever you see someone put out a keynote, and on their keynote is like, it's a white keynote with black words, and it has like the full page, the slide is full of like notes, and they're teaching, and they're walking through this, you can leave.
Yeah.
I have a slide deck, not because I need it, but because I use it as a way to keep the crowd, one more way to keep the crowd in the TikTok world we live in.
Yep.
I keep the crowd engaged by flipping a slide periodically. But correct. If you go look at my slides, the majority of all my slides have one word.
Yeah.
It's one fucking word.
Also, the difference is, because I'm not saying to never use slides, the difference is if something went wrong with the tech, which happens all the time.
Last month to one of our speakers.
If something goes wrong with the tech, you're going to keep going.
It doesn't matter.
That's the difference.
Doesn't matter.
It's like there's so many people, man, that it's like painful for me to watch them because they click it and they're like, it's not working. I don't know.
Or they put the wrong slide.
Hey, guy
in
the back. Okay, well, I guess we're gonna just wait till they get this. And it's just like, or you could just be a little bit more prepared and you could just keep talking because you know what
you're
talking
about. Be fucking great at what you do.
Yeah, exactly.
Know your fucking, be great at what you do. I'll give you an example of it costing money. Last month we had one of our speakers on stage and something happened with his slide deck. Okay. Now my opinion, this always lies on the speaker because you're the one, it's your slide deck and you got to double check, but neither here nor there. And somehow they use, he made a bunch of changes in his presentation, and somehow they use the wrong, his old presentation on this new deal he was going to do. Mm. So he was ready to make this one presentation, but instead they had the old slide deck. And to your point, he couldn't just say, hey, you know what? Go to the main slide that just has the brand or logo, and just let me teach this to you.
Yeah.
He couldn't do it because he needed a slide deck to keep him teaching the points. Well, the difference here, to put context around this, that would have been like a sales wise that went from like probably a $2.5 million room that we should have did to maybe like a $485,000 room.
No way.
That's the difference. That's the difference in that one moment of knowing your shit and being great at what you do versus not being great at what you do and you're stuck with having a cane, if you will, or a walker to help you along the way.
Well, people lose track of the folk. Like the whole point of having a stage like that is to build trust with an audience.
Yes. Yes.
And it's like, as soon as you start pulling shit like that, people stop trusting you as much. It's like, you can't, you're doing the opposite of what you built this for.
It's
like
the
subconscious thing that people are just like, they might not be sitting there thinking like, I now don't trust you.
Yeah. They're not going to say
but
that.
But it's subconscious, you know,
because like their belief.
You're displaying incompetence.
You don't know what you're talking about.
Exactly.
So why would I trust you now? That's what their subconscious brain is going. And that's why when the call to action happens, they don't move.
Yeah.
You lost them. You lost trust with the speakers, with the crowd.
Yeah, dude. Okay. So Aspire, I don't want to be respectful of your time because I know you got a bunch of stuff going on here.
I'm actually going to dinner with the Hodge twins. You know those guys? The Hodge twins?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Are they based in Vegas?
Yeah, they're based in Vegas.
Man. Okay, nice.
They seem wild. They are wild dudes.
They seem like a couple crazy,
they're a wild
crazy crew.
Yeah. So Aspire, go ahead.
Aspire. First question is why Aspire? Where did it come from? Like, because you were already doing, like Money Is, you were already doing a couple other events. Yeah. Why Aspire?
Aspire is more truthfully my passion. Remember, go back to before Aspire, before COVID, dude, I was hitting 40 grand a week, pop, 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 with no overhead. Plus I already had all these other houses I was doing as well. I had made enough money to stop. Like I was not married at the time, but no kids. So you're making 40 grand a week, pure profit on a paycheck, if you will, with no kids and no wife, like you can save a lot of money.
Yeah.
And I was still investing.
You can do whatever you want.
So I was kind of done. So was my partner, business partner, Eddie Wilson as well. And so Aspire came for me as a passion project, as a way to truly help entrepreneurs. Like I was for 20 years an entrepreneur that was always like beating my head against a wall, running as hard as I can at something, grinding, hustling, pushing as hard as I can, and could get there, but never really get there. I could do it, but I could never get to like the next level of like, I want to build a company that's worth 25 million, 50 million, 100 million. I could never get in that ballpark. Mm-hmm. I was always like the 5 million a year, all day long. Any year you want to pick, I could generate 3, 4, 5 million. But I could never get to like 50 to 100. And so along this way, I was like, dude, I want to go show entrepreneurs the way of like aspire you to like, you can do this. And for me, Aspire is a giant passion project. Truth be told, at Aspire itself, we lose freaking money. Like Aspire itself, I was just at our last one, whatever it was, a couple of days ago. And dude, like, yeah, we're down probably $1 million right now. We're negative right now off that event. But understanding how the model works and what we do, like the money's going to come. The money will be there down the road.
Yeah.
But it's the idea of helping entrepreneurs and building a community. And I think that's one thing you got to look at in business is that in business, culture, societies are constantly adapting and changing. And what used to work at one period does no longer work in what you have going on. And I think there was this shift that I was right on the cusp of. And anytime you get ahead of something, I think there's a shit ton of money to be made when you can get ahead of the kind of shift that's taking place in society. And it goes back, I can tie this back to religion. Like they just refuse to shift. They refuse to, they still want to try to go build a church by buses.
Yeah.
Right. They say, dude, they didn't, that's not why that was started. That was started in the 60s,
right?
But not for the reason that you're using it now. Yeah. You're missing the whole point of what was happening inside of it. And so, you know, culture is always shifting. So I think for us, it was a shift that took place where, to me, I look at business now is very, very community driven. And by community, I don't mean just the city. I just mean it's a community of people. And so for when we set out to go do this, I wanted to build a community, not a funnel, not a giant ass, long ass funnel. I wanted to build a community and allow the community to develop and be the heartbeat of what it is that we do. And so that's what we went and built. So before I kind of launched Aspire, I went and built out a custom app from scratch. I'm probably $1 million into the app right now. It actually makes me zero money, to be clear. Like you can't download it.
Yeah, that's how apps are.
It's only for my people. But all of my community customers live inside of the app. Everything they need, what events we're having, all of our education, our training, our platform, the communication between each other, DMs, all of it lives inside of this community that we built, and they live inside this app. It also makes it super easy for me because anytime I want to reach to my community, I just go to my one spot and they're all inside of it.
Sure.
And I can control so much inside of it. But inside that community, once the community was built, the bigger I focus all my time on building that community over bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And as that community gets bigger and bigger, the amount of opportunity that comes our way right now is freaking stupidly insane.
Yeah, yeah.
The amount of opportunity that comes our way from outsiders wanting to jump inside of a business deal, if you will, inside of a community. Uniquely, though, 95 to 99% of the time, my answer is no. Because I'm not here to sell my community something.
Yeah.
I'm here to provide value to my community and then figure out what my community wants. And based off of what my community wants, I will provide them that service, but only based off of what they actually freaking want. And we have testing mechanisms that we do that with. I think it's a giant wave of the future of how business is going to be heading inside of it versus kind of this old model, which still works. There's pieces we still use, but for a long time, the model has been top of the funnel, put them in a funnel, and then hit them all the way down the funnel through the whole process. And I think that model is getting coming to its end of its life.
It's more,
in my opinion,
transactional.
It's a very, very transactional business.
Burn and turn type.
And again, I'm not saying it's bad. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that there's not pieces that we still use. But I'm saying building a model off of, I'm just going to build a giant funnel and push people through it. Again, I guess if you were just trying to make money, right? If the end goal was just like strictly money driven, okay, yeah, that's probably a better model to go. Mine's a long-term play.
Yeah.
I turn money down fucking constantly because I'm building a community. Therefore, my main job is to take care of the community and allow the community to develop bigger and bigger and bigger. And as it gets bigger and bigger, dude, bigger and bigger opportunities come my way that if I can't let some of them out of the bag yet, but some of the shit that is in front of us right now is I never saw it coming. We've only been in business for a year, bro.
Yeah.
Aspire's been a year.
Yeah, as well.
And the shit that is coming our way from the outside right now, like, hey, we want to do this with you. We don't do this with you. And if I started naming names, you'd be like, no fucking way. No fucking way that these people are trying to do business with you right now.
So that kind of brings me to my next point. The show is called Travis Makes Friends.
Yeah.
You speak all Build Your Network. We talk a lot about relationship building and how to really level up the relationships in your life to help you continue to level up yourself. Because obviously you're the average of the five people you spend most time with, right? So first off, tell me about your relationship with Eddie a little bit more, kind of how that came about, and then where you think you would be in all these businesses without him. And then Fleischman too, with Dan Fleischman. How did that kind of come about?
Yeah, so first of all, relationships are everything, not just in business, but in life. If you look at life as a whole, we as humans hyper desire and want relationships. Like there are very, very few people, humans, that are alive that do not want other human relationships. And normally when you find those people, I know a couple of them, there's something wrong. Mm. They're on the chart. They're off on something. Us as humans want relationships and as a whole. In business, it's no different, right? And so for me and Eddie, I've been in a lot of partnerships before, just to be clear, that have went to hell in a handbasket and ended in massive lawsuits. And many reasons why my fault, their fault, but at the end of the day, and Eddie was the same way. Where me and Eddie connected at and why it's hit so well this time is I think part of it's just the maturity of where we're at in life, right? He had already made a bunch of money. He was retired when I went to him and said, hey, I want to go do this thing. Number one, so there's not this like financial crunch that both of us are in, right? Mm. That's one piece of it. But in the relationship, Eddie has his lane and I have my lane. If you know me and Eddie, we're very opposites of each other. I'm the visionary side of it. He's very much a big picture implementer, operator on his side. And we have two separate lanes. And so one reason it works so well is that I hyper stay in my lane and he hyper stays in his lane. Mm. I'll support him in his lane. And if there's a decision that company being made that I might not agree with, but it's in his lane, he gets veto power inside of it, and vice versa on my side. Because of that, the relationship has been extremely, extremely well. And also, I'll tell you this, for those that are looking in business or looking in partnerships, when me and Eddie sat down to do our partnership, we said, okay, if we do this partnership, we have to be 100% all in, or just for us, it just won't work. And what I mean by that is he already had some companies. I had some of their side stuff. And we said, hey, the only way this is going to work is if we both 100% go all in together, which means everything that you own, I own. Everything that I own, you own. We are 100% 50-50 down the line. In our operating agreement, there are clauses that say if one of us wants to do a business and the other one doesn't, the answer is no. If you came to me right now and said, hey, I want to do this deal with you, Drew, and I want to do whatever it is, podcasting stuff with you, I can't do that deal with you right now. I have to buy my contract in my corporation. I got to go back to Eddie, explain to him the deal, and let him, and then me and him can decide if we want to do that. If he says no, I can't still come back to you and do the deal. Even if he doesn't want to, then because it takes the focus off of what me and him are building, and now me and you are doing this thing over here, and then there's this thing over here, right?
Sure.
So there's a lot of rules that we set in place inside of it that has worked very, very well. So if you go in partnership, it's very important to understand deep definitions of what's what and who's doing what, and understanding and then abiding by it. Fleischman came along. Obviously, I knew Fleischman for probably 6 years. I knew Eddie before our business for probably 15 years. And then Fleischman, I knew for probably 6 or 7 years. And that one we were not looking for. That one, he came to one of our Aspire events. And then just a lot of stuff that he does, we do very similar in. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And he came to me and was like, dude, I'm doing these events. You're doing these events. Why don't we partner on these events? I went back to Eddie and it was like, well, we're interested, come down. And then long story short, in like a 3 week period, it was like, damn, the only way this is going to work is if you're all in. So either everything that you own, we own, and everything we own, you own, or we're out of this deal. Mm-hmm. Because there's too many moving parts, right? Like to keep track of, like, if you know Dan's everywhere speaking. If every time I turn around, Dan's got a new deal going on.
Yeah.
But we're supposed to be equal partners over here. It's like, well, a lot of the stuff you're getting access to, let's say, is indirectly or directly based off of.
You can't like compartmentalize the partnership.
This over here, like, you know what I mean? And vice versa. And so we did the same thing. We went all in and said, okay, all your companies belong to us and all of our companies belong to you. And that created a 33 partnership side of the company. of what we do, how we do it, how it works, et cetera, inside of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. I wanted to make sure I touched on that because now you guys are also, and I referred to Dan as one of like the most expert kind of networkers I've ever met in my life. And he's always done it really, really well. And now you guys are all kind of partnering together and doing it at a high level and using events to do this. And so this will be the last thing I chat with you about. And then I'll let you get going to dinner. So I tell people all the time to start a podcast. And the reason for that is not necessarily to go gain an audience, to gain followers or subscribers and blah, blah, blah. It's just to meet people.
Right.
It's just to get access to people who would normally not give you access to them.
Sure.
And you guys have done that same exact thing, but not with podcasts, with this massive event, which has now, you know, enabled you to not only book one, a lot of people will put on an event and they spend a bunch of money on it and they get Magic Johnson and they get David Goggins and they get, you know, all their favorite people and they put them into a stage and it's like, wow, that was awesome. And then they kind of just like smoke a cigar and they celebrate and they're done.
Right.
And it's like, you guys are doing this so often that now you have real relationships and friendships with the biggest names, the top paid speakers, with the biggest audiences in the world. And then that's allowing you to build this company off of the back of what we call OPA, other people's audiences. I guess how intentional was that, if at all?
100%, without a doubt, one of the most intentional things that I did inside of it. In my classes, sometimes as I'm teaching, I'll break into a little bit of this piece of it. But if you ever come to an Aspire event, it's very, very, I don't think you've been to one. Have you, Aspire, yet?
Nope.
It is very, very driven off of customer experience. Okay. The amount of money that we spend, stupid amounts of money to create a customer experience and walk away from money. I mean, there are so many people that want to, say, sponsor our events or be a vendor at our events and pay us $100,000 to speak for 15 minutes on our stage. Mm-hmm. And the answer is like, no, no. Or they want to be a vendor in a booth. And the answer is, the reason is because everything goes back to customer experience. And there is so much signage in our, there is stuff that is hanging from the ceilings of signage. There is signage everywhere you go. From the time a customer walks in, floor stickers on the floor, smell in the, like, I walk through all of it and create all of it before every event. And the day before the event, I do the final walkthrough, change anything. And I mean, we change the angle of what a pop-up sign is positioned at. It's wild to see and understand. As deep as I go in experience on that side, if you go behind the stage, I am that deep inside of experience on my talent side. So therefore, that means I spend a lot of extra staff people to make sure that everything from how we communicate with them and who communicates with them, how we pick them up when they come in the backstage. When they come in the backstage, the amount of security that I have, the amount of branding that I have, my branding starts backstage with them. And so when they walk down, you know, kind of those convention centers or hotels, kind of backstage, I line that with a 20-foot pink and purple carpet that says Aspire.
Yeah, yeah.
And it gives them a path to where we go. There's signage along the way. I don't have to do any of that, but I start creating experience, and then it goes in the green room, and then it goes in how we communicate, who's allowed in the green room. It goes into a lot of stuff that I do there, creating a experience for the speaker. And I 100% do it on purpose. And I actually learned this from podcasting, to be clear with you. And so inside of that, because of that, I then try to, in all my contracts that I do with them, I'll say, okay, hey, you're going to come and speak for 1 hour, whatever it is, right? Or you're going to do a moderated Q&A with me for an hour on stage. And then there would be a 15-minute kind of recap podcast, if you want to call it that. It's not really a podcast, but a kind of a 15-minute recap with me in the room. Mm-hmm. And therefore, I know that I get 15 minutes one-on-one with every single speaker. With everybody's gone. It's just me and then maybe my camera crew, and I'm asking them questions and trying to build a relationship. Sometimes it hits. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it doesn't. Mm-hmm. What happens, though, is because we're very, very good at that. The roles have now reversed. We're a year into this, and the roles have reversed. Instead of us chasing speakers down, bro, I get hit by every big name speaker you could imagine. And then once they come to the event, as soon as the event's over, they'll DM me, because I'll never ask for the phone number. Like, I'll never It's like one of the rules. Like, yeah, I tell my team, even my booking person, his name is Alex, never asks for a cell phone number. But what they'll do is they'll chase me down on DM and Instagram, and they'll DM me. It happens all the freaking time. And then the relationship starts. And from that relationship, there's been so many stuff, so much stuff that has happened from it. Yes, from the speaking side and making it easier and lowering fees and all, because they want to get in. Those are like the guaranteed, like almost basics of understanding it. However, like things now were like, now we're getting to the point where we're allowed to market on their social media accounts and they give us access to their social media with these huge celebrities. And we can run our ads for them on their social media accounts. Introductions from their friends because they want to stay like in our good side, deals that we're working on, business. The contacts that I'm bringing in, having phone calls and meetings with, are not even the speakers. They're the speakers. They're like the speakers' mentors. That they reached out and she's like, dude, you got to get to understand this piece of what's going on here. So all of that is 100% on purpose, choreographed by me for the purpose of trying to build a relationship. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. I'm okay with either way. It's not me manipulating a situation. It's me being real to who I am. I want you to have a great time. I want you to enjoy what you're doing with me. I want you to leave there, no matter if we ever work again, I want you to leave there and say, dude, that was the best speaking experience that I've ever had. And inside of that, there might be an opportunity for me and you to work together on some business. If there is, great. If there's not, great. But from it, dude, we have gotten so much freaking business. And I think it's what a lot of people misunderstand about. You hit the nail on the head. I just basically took my original podcast, which I did the same thing in my podcast. You remember my old podcast? You came to my office. There was a tour given to you. There was a green room there for you. There's all this stuff that I did. And a podcast would last four or five hours. One podcast would, not because the show was only an hour, but what we did because building that relationship and then the dinner parties we would throw afterwards, right? Created a ton of relationships. And I just took that to the next level, right? There's no way, let's say, that I was going to get Marcus Lemonis to pick. I could have a great business idea. I can't call Marcus Lemonis before I knew him and be like, hey, Marcus, let's do this deal. He'll never fucking pick up the phone.
Of course.
But when I called him and said, hey, we're going to put this event on for entrepreneurs, and we'd love to have you come and speak at it. I'll pay you X amount of dollars and fly you out. He picked up the phone. And then he's like, well, tell me more about what you do. And then that relationship, like all of them, they start and they develop and build. Now, if I just saw this yesterday. I think it was yesterday I was in town, and I saw a post from Marcus Lemonis, who I love dearly. And on it, it was like, it was him speaking at Aspire, and he said, visit my 2024 Aspire speaking tour. It literally was like taking ownership. That's how much he like cares about Aspire. Today, Magic Johnson posted me. Go to his Instagram. It's me. He posted me, not on a story, on his wall and tagged me. Why? Because we create that relationship with them. You know how hard it is to get Magic Johnson to freaking post about you? It's extremely difficult. And I get it all the time. All the time. He posted today about me and tagged me in the post.
That's what I tell people, man. It's like, you're not, you don't, because I get this kind of, you know, snarky vibe from people sometimes. Like, well, you're just paying for relationships and that's not a real relationship. It's like, no, no, no. You're not paying for relationships. You're paying for access. And then you have to build a real relationship after that.
It, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't.
Exactly. That to your point, that's why I wanted to bring it up because I have somebody on my podcast who I've never spoken to again, but I'll have somebody on my podcast who I can call up at any time and ask for advice at any time, who's sold a company for $1 billion. It's that's like, sometimes it doesn't work out. Sometimes it does. You know, people are people, people are fickle, and not, and you're not supposed to have a deep relationship with everybody that you meet. That's not how relationships work. So it's just paying for the access so you can actually get in the room with somebody. And then from there, you just, you build the relationship like you normally would. But yeah, dude, this has been awesome. Like I said, I want to get you out of here. I appreciate you taking the time to come on the show. We'll have to do a part two sometime, maybe at maybe a green room or something, Aspire event or something. We'll make it happen at some point. But I appreciate you coming on. Where can people go, you know, get a little bit more of what you guys are working on?
You just go to my Instagram. If you want to follow me or whatever, you can go to my Instagram, follow me there if you want to. Again, the day,
that's,
I
just
think,
at Andrew Cordell.
Just my name, at Andrew Cordell. Again, I think my position is like, I always say this, like, I don't have anything to sell you. I want you to be an entrepreneur, and I want you to chase your dreams. I want you to be passionate about what you do. I want to aspire you to be more, do more, achieve more. You are built for fucking greatness. And sometimes entrepreneurs, we peel back on that. We're afraid of it. And I think my main drive right now is like, fucking go after it, dude. You got one life on this earth, right? Yeah. And you can achieve so much more if you want to go do it. That's kind of my own driving message to everybody. And I'll leave you my famous ending statement, which is, see you at the top, motherfuckers.
At Andrew Cordell, head over to Instagram, give him a follow, shoot him a DM, tell him you heard about him here on the show. Dude, thanks so much for doing this. A lot of fun.
Love you.
That's it for today's episode. Thanks for spending some time with me and my friends. If you want to be better friends with me, then head over to travischappell.com/team to subscribe to my free newsletter, Your Friend Travis, where I share what's on my mind about life, building a business, raising kids, being married, and anything else I would normally share with my close circle of friends. That's travischappell.com/team. And my biggest ask of you, since I'm sharing my friends with you, is to share this episode with a friend of yours that hasn't listened to the show yet and leave us a quick 5-star rating in Apple Podcasts and in Spotify. It would mean the world to us as it helps us make sure that this show continues to be more valuable to you. Thanks in advance, and I'll catch you on the next episode.
With everything you have on your plate, earning your degree online seems impossible. But at Grand Canyon University, we specialize in helping you fit a master's degree in education into your busy day. Your graduation team, led by your own GCU counselor, provides you with the personal support you need to succeed. Achieve your goals with a plan and team behind you. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Visit gcu.edu.